at WPFW.org.
Welcome to The Collision.
The Collision, where sports and politics smash. Thursdays at 10 a.m. and on iTunes and Google Play. WPFW, Washington, D.C.
Recording in progress.
Welcome to On the Margin with Ethelbert Miller. My guest today is Nicholas Del Banco. Nicholas Del Banco is the author of Still Life at 80, a memoir. Nicholas Del Banco is the author of more than 30 works of fiction and nonfiction. He was the founding director of the Bennington Summer Writing Workshop and created the Low Residency MFA program there. How are you doing today, Nicholas?
I'm fine, and I'm very glad to be even distantly in touch with you.
Okay. Well, let's talk about the memoir in general, because many people who might be listening are always saying, oh, I want to write a memoir. What are some of the do's and don'ts of writing a memoir? And then also, why did you structure Still Life at 80 the way you did in terms of the three sections?
Right. Well, first of all, that's a complicated question to answer because memoir has become a hydra-headed thing these years. Indeed, I think in a way it's fair to say that it's become the signature mode of the present moment, the first person recall or recounting of one's life. I mean, if you look back on the long history of the written word, there was a time when poetry had primacy, when theater had primacy, when the novel had primacy. But I think it's probably accurate that in our present moment, the memoir is the signature form. More people want to write it than want to write novels, for instance. And that has something to do, of course, with the spread of the technological spread of access to language, so that a blog or a post or just an email becomes an occasion for the first person. And everybody and their brother feels that they have a story to tell. I'm sounding...
It's almost as if everyone has a cell phone to record something.
Well, exactly. I'm sounding a little ungenerous about that, perhaps, and I certainly don't mean to dismiss the idea of self-reportage or witness, but a friend of mine calls it the memoir, and I'm afraid that that's, still in the back of my brain. As I have done, as you know, I've published a lot of books, and I've always sort of shied away from the first person and the idea of memoir. But at the age of 80, it suddenly seemed like I ought to get some of this down and put it in, the shape of a single text. I'm not sure, it's a little hard for me to reconstruct it now. I'm not sure that when I began to write it, I thought I would publish it. Mm-hmm. But as time went on and as I got more and more involved in the telling of this particular tale, I came closer to the idea that it should be published, and it has been. A corollary to that, Albert, is that much of this book is, as you suggested already, about the idea of memoir or autobiography, and is not particularly about me. I mean, I don't say I was born on such and such a day and such a place, and my parents were called, and, you know, my brothers do the following. It's more a kind of speculative inquiry into the genre itself. So if you want to...
I did notice something that you did. If we go and look at your book, Why Writing Matters, you did take segments of that to incorporate into Still Life at 80. I'm thinking about the profiles of Updike and Gardner.
That's exactly right. What you're referring to is a section in this book which basically repeats the book that I had written before, which was called Why Writing Matters. That book as part of a series that Yale University Press publishes called Why X Matters, in effect, why architecture matters, why baseball matters. And by the time they got to the letter W, they flattering they asked me. So I did write a book that was more or less about the business of writing, of being a teacher and of having had students and of having been a student. And in that text, I went on at some length about three of my masters, actually more, but three of them who are still household names. One was John Gardner, one was John Updike, and one was James Baldwin, each of whom mattered. And when it came to putting this book together, it seemed simply silly not to include that history. That's true of an essay that I wrote, 20 years ago, about being a father of daughters. I cribbed that also and just put it together because this book, Still Life at 80, is a sort of mosaic. It's a retrospect that's made up of several different components. And in the case of the two that I've just referred to, it seemed foolish to pretend that I hadn't been there before. So I folded it in.
Well, most of this question, Nicholas.
Sure.
Is there an art to aging?
That's a serious question also, and not one I know how to answer for all of your readership or viewership. I wrote a book about 10 years ago, 12 years ago, called Lastingness, The Art of Old Age. And it was about painters, writers, and musicians who at least maintained and in some degree advanced their art past the age of 70, which for obvious reasons was a subject that was of interest to me at the time. I had to begin with the sense that that was relatively rare, that not many artists improved or even maintained their art in older age. But as you, of course, know, old age is a mutable number and a flexible thing. And we are, as a species, much older now than was the case 100 years ago, not to mention 1,000 or 10,000, certainly. So that it's no longer extraordinary that we have artists who continue in their 60s, 70s, 80s, and even now their 90s to practice their work.
Well, what are some of the mental and physical challenges? Because you went through a lot of health issues over the last few years.
I did, and I'm hoping to, that they are behind me. It's a curious and open-ended question. I mean, if you're a baseball player or a ballerina, you kind of know that your physical prowess will diminish at a certain point, and that at the age of 40 or at the outside 50, you're not going to be dancing or hitting home runs the way
you start managing and you do choreography.
Exactly so. On the face of it, there's no real reason why an artist shouldn't be able to maintain and indeed enlarge their art past the age of physical prowess. You may have an assistant if you're a sculptor or even an important painter. As you say, you may become a choreographer rather than a dancer. But as long as you retain your mental agility and facility, there's no self-evident reason why art shouldn't improve. What one hopes to be able to do is replenish energy with a kind of wisdom, I suppose is the word for it, to be able to do in one's older age what one kind of labored to accomplish early on.
Let's talk about aging with a partner, because I could look at Still Life at 80 and say, Nicholas, this is a love story to your wife. The book is dedicated to her. The last sentence in the book is about her. Talk about that, because that seems to add a lot to the quality of your life.
That's absolutely true, and that's an accurate reading. The book, the first words of the book and the last words of the book are my wife's name, Elena, and it is a kind of love story to her, or about her. And I realize, well, this is one of the components of aging also. You recognize in retrospect what you didn't know in prospect. Mm-hmm. Chance encounters and casual meetings become causal and crucial and so on. And so when I first met Elena, I was a kid. I mean, I was 18, she was 17. It took us almost a decade to declare that we would like to be husband and wife. But she has been my lifelong partner, and I live in the hope that she will continue to be that way. And both her parents died in their mid-90s, so the odds are pretty good. When you spend your time with a single shared presence, and when you produce children and therefore grandchildren, it turns out that, you know, Nicholas and Elena is a much more accurate description of me than Nicholas, mm-hmm. pure and simple. And therefore, this book is importantly about our shared history. Yes.
You started out talking about you own seven homes. And I said, wow, Nicholas, I wonder if you ever had a need for a retreat.
You mean from those homes?
Yeah, right, from those homes. That you, even though you have the homes, and you describe each one and how important they are, I wondered whether there was a need for you to, well, let me go back. I was wondering when you selected some of these homes, you know, and I'm thinking about myself in this case, that you said, okay, I'm going to select this house because this is where I'm going to put my office, my den. This is where the sunlight comes in. This is going to give me inspiration. I was just wondering, when you look at these homes, did you approach it as a writer?
Yes, I think that's so. And to attach to the previous question about did I ever want to retreat, early on I did what most or many young writers do, actively seek out a retreat and go and stay in places like Yaddo and McDowell and others that are a little less famous. And I've still done that from time to time, mostly in Europe, in Italy at Bellagio and a place called Civitella Ranieri. Because it is nice to have somebody else cook your meals and make sure that the phone doesn't ring and so on and so forth. But the truth is that I've been lucky enough in my life to create my own environments. And as you've just suggested about yourself, I was very conscious of, you know, what Thoreau said, going up attic and having a room where I was my own master. There's a small story about that, which attaches, I guess, to one of the figures we glancingly mentioned. I had been, in effect, the student and certainly the admirer of John Updike way back when, and he famously had an office in the town of Ipswich to which he would repair, leaving his wife and children behind and working a kind of a standard work day in the silence of that space. And I thought to myself, well, you know, that's a really damn good idea, and I should do that too, and I'll grow up to be Updike. And so when we settled in Vermont, in Bennington, I actually got or rented a space from a friend in the nearby little village of North Bennington and said, this will be my studio and I'll do what Updike did. and spent a certain amount of time, again with Elena's help, readying it as an office, you know, painting it and putting in certain ideal pieces of furniture and bookshelves and what have you, until it was, in fact, an extremely nice and welcoming space. And once it was completely to my satisfaction, I never went there again. I thought, you know, for Christ's sakes, don't be pretentious. You don't need to go off to the office. You've got one in your house. So I stayed at home. Right. And by and large, I've been a domestic creature in that sense, so that the seven houses I report on each had spaces in which I could work.
I want to go back to, you've mentioned Updike. I want to go back to something which I feel is tied, especially when one lives long, the sense of loss, because many times you look up, people who are younger are passing away. So if I look at Updike, he died in 2009, Gardner died in 1982, Baldwin died in 1987. How did those deaths affect you?
In each case, very deeply. I am now considerably the elder of that particular tribe, but all my working life, I looked up to them, and they were my elders and betters. And it's very strange to recognize that you've outlasted most of your models and now perhaps have become a model to other and younger authors. Let me be specific. Updike was 10 years my senior, and though I knew about his latter illness, it still came as a shock to me, because I had been in touch with him relatively briefly before he died. It still came as a shock to me to assume that he wouldn't be around for me to look up to any longer. John Gardner was a little bit of a different condition. He was also my senior, but by less of a span. And he died, as I think you know, in a motorcycle crash,
right.
An accident in what now seems to me the ludicrously young age and stage of 49. And 2 days after his death, I received a letter from him in the mail saying he looked forward to seeing Elena and me at his own projected wedding on Saturday. And that was spooky, because there's a difference between dying of disease and of an accident. I am his, excuse me, his literary executor. And so it devolved upon me to try and make sense out of the stuff that was in his motorcycle side bag, the manuscript he'd been working on. And so he stayed with me kind of as a shocked reminder of how one ought to be careful. In the case of Jimmy Baldwin, our intimacy, which was real and long, had elapsed a little by the time of his death, by which I mean we were no longer neighbors as we had been in the south of France, and I saw him mostly in public and only intermittently. I also knew, of course, that he was ill, and I'm a little, this is tangential to what you just asked, but he is, of course, a crucial player right now and again, and should be. But when we were close, he was living in exile and not entirely in public favor. The black radicals of the time, I mean, people like Eldridge Cleaver and Huey Newton and what have you, had dismissed him a little bit as an Uncle Tom. The white establishment was wary of him, as they always had been. And so he was conscious of himself as an outsider. I don't know that there's a single writer, dead or alive, who's more current in the conversation than Baldwin right now, in part because this is the centennial of his birth, but mostly because the things that matter to him continue, alas, to matter to us as a nation now. And so in a certain way, he's as present to me at the present moment as he was when, oh my gosh, 20, 25 years ago, he died.
Well, you know, when you mentioned this, Nicholas Delbanco, what I was thinking of, especially when you live a long time, there are so many writers I've known in my life who have committed suicide. You know, and I feel sometimes there's the anger, there's the loss. You say, okay, so-and-so was at this particular point in their life, you know, what was happening? Could I have, as a friend, done more in terms of dealt them navigate maybe through depression? How have you dealt with that?
The question of failing one's friends is one we continue to ask, and to the best of my incompetence, I try not to do so. I try to stay in touch and be supportive. But as you point out, time has shifted the terms of the equation, so that I'm now the elder, not the junior, and only rarely do I look at somebody straight across the way I did with the Alan Chews, to whom you also made reference earlier. I think whether you're dealing with your juniors, your coevals, or your seniors, you kind of have to do the same thing, which is pay attention and try to be supportive. I don't draw a distinction in that regard between my students and my masters. But it is simply the flat fact of longevity that more of my writer friends are dead than are alive.
Right. Well, you mentioned in your book, Still Life at 80, that you're writing about Updike, you're writing about Gardner and Bowen, but there are so many other writers. I want you to talk about two who are women, who I really had a lot of admiration for. One is Mary Lee Settle, and the other is Grace Paley. If you could just talk about what they meant to your life.
You have read the book closely, haven't you? I think what I admire most about them in retrospect was just how feisty they were, how full of life and kind of an unrelenting energy. There's one little story about Grace that I think I should tell. After I was at Bennington, I went to the University of Michigan, where I also sort of founded the writing program and was there for, you know, 30 years. And one of my, not exactly duties, but happy business propositions was to propose writers who got honorary degrees there. So I was able to get honorary degrees for Toni Morrison and Joyce Carol Oates and any number of others. But I did get an honorary degree for Grace. And the business of the university is that you had to come to the college or to the university to receive the degree. You had to get it in person. And they paid the ticket and the hotel and all of that. But there wasn't any honorarium attached. There was the honor. And I was supposed always to go to the airport to meet my candidate and bring him or her happily back to Ann Arbor. So I went to this is quite a long time ago, when you were still able to get past security and wait at the gate. So I went to the gate for Grace to arrive, and she didn't. And I got very nervous. And called and couldn't reach her, and and this, that, and the other thing. And finally, there was another flight off of which she kind of came clumping. I mean, this is 2 or 3 hours later than when I first arrived. And I said to her, "Grace, what happened?" And she said, "Doll, I wanted to save you some money." because she found out that from the Burlington airport, she could fly to Detroit via, I don't know, I think it was Baltimore and make it, or Philadelphia, and make a change. And it was cheaper than if she flew straight ahead. And I said, "Listen, you know, the university actually would have flown you first class. They're very avid to have you here, and you're doing great." She said, no, it's worth less to me than it is to you that I should say so. And then she had and was tempted to cancel it. She had some trouble with her eyes. Yeah. An operation that had gone bad. And when she arrived, she was in very considerable pain. And so I took her more or less immediately to the Kellogg Eye Center in Ann Arbor, where, as it happened, I knew the director and said, "Look, this is a lady of consequence, and she's going to get an honorary degree tomorrow. And can you give her any help?" So this man did. His name is Paul Lichter. He was excellent. Spent a couple of fruitful hours with her, and I think cured the ill or the ail. When we were leaving, I said, "Look, the university will pay you for what you've just done." And he said, "No." He said, "She's a neat lady."
Well, go ahead.
Yeah. Well, that's about it. And yeah. I mean, I have versions of that about Mary Lee also. But
yeah, talk about Mary Lee before we take our break. Because, you know, she was so key to the Penn Faulkner Foundation.
Absolutely.
You know, moving it up from to D.C., actually.
She and George Garrett together were kind of the crucial players there. Because we're going to take a break, I'll be brief about her. And I didn't know her as well as I knew Grace. But she had a kind of arrogant modesty, which really stays with me. Just a sense of her own worth, as well as an intermittently aggrieved sense that the world hadn't been paying sufficient attention. And she had been, I think, a great beauty. She still had a powerful physical presence when I met her first. And every once in a while, she would just sort of give you a sidelong reference to something she'd done that would knock your socks off. She was quite something, and I think Grace's reputation has at least retained its power, but Mary Lee is too little attended to now and should be remedied.
Yeah, that's why I wanted you to mention it. Well, Nicholas Del Banco, we're going to take a little break here. My guest today on the margin is Nicholas Del Banco. We're talking about his memoir, Still Life at 80. My name is Ethelbert Miller. The show's On the Margin, the station's WPFW 89.3 FM.
This is your social justice calendar for the week of Monday, January 6th, 2025. Happy New Year. To begin, on Friday, January 10th from 8 a.m. to 5 p.m., there will be a discussion around improving cultural congruency across mental health care delivery network located on 800 Main Avenue Southwest. More info can be found on www.psychiatry.org. Also on January 10th at 5 p.m., there will be Mr. DC, Men of Culture Community and Networking Event at Martin Luther King Jr. Memorial Library Auditorium. There will also be a race relations panel discussion at 5 p.m. with the mayor of Glenarden, Maryland. Tickets and more info can be found on eventbrite.com. The next day, DC for Palestine is holding a teach-in on the history and culture of the Palestinian people, their resistance against occupation, and how this relates to the issues facing DC. At the Deanwood Community Center Large Multipurpose Room on Saturday, January 11th from 2 to 3:30 p.m. More info can be found on Instagram at DC4Palestine. Finally, on January 12th from 4 to 6 p.m. at the Festival Center, 1640 Columbia Road Northwest, there will be a Kids Bake Off for Palestine. You can bake in the competition or simply be in community. Proceeds support the Gaza Soup Kitchen and displaced families in Cairo. More info can be found on FusedGlassCommunityStrategies.org. The WPFW Social Justice Calendar connects you with the heartbeat of grassroots activism in the DMV. Submissions can be emailed to socialjustice@wpfw.org. Please include the name, date, and address of the event. Submissions are due by Thursday at 5 p.m. at least 1 week in advance of your event. The Social Justice Calendar is one more way WPFW builds a better world, one broadcast at a time.
Okay, we're back on the margin with my guest, Nicholas Del Banco. We're talking about his memoir, Still Life at 80. Nicholas, talk about the cover of your book, which you describe in part three, Things of This World. And I'm still thinking of your uncle, I think, getting his head stuck in that. But talk about the cover of the book, yeah. so that people know if they're in a bookstore what to look for.
Well, thank you. In fact, I can hold it up. Is that visible?
Right. Okay. Yeah. Well, you know, we're recording this on Zoom, but everybody's hearing it on radio.
Okay. Fine.
You have to describe it.
Yeah, and then I want to do something that attaches to what we were talking about earlier. The cover of this book is a mask, which I own and inherited from my father. And it's an Ikoi mask. K-O-I, which is the name of a tribe in the area of Africa between Nigeria and Cameroons and the Ejigam area. Anyway, it's larger than life size, though only a little, because you're supposed to be able to put your own head inside it. It's a hollowed out Janus-faced mask, by which I mean it's a face that that goes both forward and back, and it represents life and death. The death mask, which is similar to the life mask, though it's darker colored, has closed eyes, and the other mask has open eyes and a kind of a smile that's got bamboo teeth inside it. It's very, very stylized and yet lifelike, as much of the wonderful African art carving can be. It's covered in skin, which as a child I was convinced was human skin. I think it's now clear that it was antelope skin.
That was just to scare you, Nicholas.
That's probably right. Anyway, and it has, at the base of the neck, has holes drilled in it. And in African art, the important distinction really is whether the artifact was created for use and has been used, or whether it's something that's created for sale, and which can also be beautiful, but you buy it on the street corner or in a museum shop or what have you. These holes would have been filled by raffia, a long corn-like skein in which the wearer would dress himself, so that there would be this big mask and then a floor-length shimmying corn-like dress. Anyway, my uncle, who was probably 50 at the time and had a sense of humor, or maybe a little too much to drink, took it one day from where it was sitting on top of the piano and put his own head in it and danced around to my 3 or 4 year old amazement, and, you know, made hoof, hoof, hoof sounds or something like that, as if he were in a ritual observance. And I guess I was entertained, my parents were, but then he couldn't get it off. maybe he'd sweated, maybe it had shifted. And it took him a long time to remove his own white haired and flushed face from this bleak and dignified mask. And I've always remembered that as an emblem of, of life and death, because he too died at 95. If I may, Attleberry, I'm going to read a brief passage from Still Life at 80, which seems to me to attach to much of what we've been discussing before. It's the name of an artist and a politician whom we hadn't mentioned, but who was in some sense my master also, my kind of great white grandfather. I mean, we weren't related, but he took me under his wing in his 80s, and I was in my early 20s. I'm referring to Max Eastman, who he published more than 20 books, volumes of poetry, biography, and political commentary, as well as a set of translations from the Russian. He was, in fact, Trotsky's translator. Anyway, this is a couple of paragraphs I'd like to read, because they do attach to this matter of growing old and doing so gracefully, as he certainly did, and also of becoming, in turn, the elder. We're talking about the early mid-1980s now. I remember staying with him on Martha's Vineyard one October. His wife, Yvette, was off to New York for a shopping trip, and she asked me to sleep in their house. A favor to me, really, since my own hut was unheated. I was full of beans and bravado and would get to work by 6, waking up and clacking at the keys in my upstairs bedroom. In the first pause, however, I could hear his steady hunt and peck in the study underneath. He'd been at work well before. So we'd share a cup of coffee and a comment on the news, then I'd fuss at my novel again. At 9 o'clock, I'd take a break, tear off my clothes, and run down the hill to the pond. The morning would be glorious, that crystalline light, those sizable skies, the pine trees somehow greener against the sere scrub oak. And always, out there in the still warm water, Max would lift his hand to me, his white mane on the wavelets like some snowy egrets, grinning. Time passed. He died at 86 in 1969. But it takes no effort to see this again, an old man waving from the water at a youth on the near shore. They're naked, both of them. The sun slants over Lobsterville. A few day sailors might be on the pond, or someone in a kayak, or mussling, or digging clams. Gulls drift past incurious. The beach smells of sea wrack and weed. There's a busy imitation of silence. The man in the water, bobbing, flutters heels and hands. The young one runs to meet him, and it's all a perfect clarity until he does a surface dive and, splashing, shuts his eyes. Mm.
You're listening to Nicholas Del Banco reading from his memoir, Still Life at 80. Thank you for that reading excerpt, Nicholas.
More than welcome. But it does seem to be about youth and old age.
Right. I wanted to, in the third section of your memoir, there's a reference of a book that had a very deep impact on my life. You make reference to Herman Kahn, Thinking About the Unthinkable. Got me into, like, you know, think tanks, you know, I think it was at the Rand Research and Development think tank. But that was where people were really thinking about that nuclear war, then the Cuban crisis. And we both have grandchildren. And, right. And we think about, you know, back then we wondered whether it was going to be a future, whether we would all be annihilated. And I wondered in terms of being grandparents, not being fearful of nuclear war, but being fearful that we might lose democracy.
Well, that is one of the blessed but cursed components of a long life. I no longer have any conscious fear of dying or a strong sense that it would be too soon. Still life at 80, I started it actually because Elena gave me a wonderful party at our home in Cape Cod for my 80th birthday. And when the last guest had left, I thought to myself, you know what, this is worth recording, this is worth reporting on, and it might perhaps be useful to others in their time. But I'm now 82 and closer to what I suppose is the necessary end. And I, perhaps like you, I'm being presumptuous here, but I don't have any particular fear of death. I do of diminution and a kind of the slow collapse of faculties, but not of leaving this planet. That is, of course, not the case about my children, and more importantly, in this context, their children. We are necessarily the custodians of a planet and a democracy that is at risk. And I'm much more concerned for them than I am for myself. I'm much more fearful about the world that they will inherit than the one from which I will depart. And I suspect this is true of most of us in our older age, that we fear for what's to come. I don't know how precise you want me to be or how specific you want me to be.
I'll tell you why I was afraid. I was really looking at, I have three granddaughters. I have four grandkids, but I have three granddaughters. And I was looking at women in Afghanistan, especially in Afghanistan, where all of a sudden, you know, a government comes in and women can't even go out of the house anymore. You know, I'm looking at women in Iran. I'm looking at women who might be living in Texas or in one of the other states, and all of a sudden they have a health issue dealing with pregnancy. Rights that we thought women would have seem to be, when you look internationally, just being taken away.
That's true, and that's inarguable, and that's awful. I have been to both Iran and Afghanistan way back in the Pleistocene, and I don't think, frankly, that things were much better for women 50 years ago. I spent some time in Afghanistan and rarely saw a woman or anyone I could identify beneath her clothing. I think actually, per contre, there was a sudden sunburst of possibility, a sudden sense of hope that there would be equality engendered and preserved. And you're absolutely right, it's backtracking now and no longer so easily available or so hopefully available to women or to dissidents of any stripe and variety. But I think, and this is a small corrective to what you were saying, I think we're closer to where we were than where we want to be and briefly thought we might become. You're absolutely right. It's horrifying all around the world and importantly in our country that these rights, these hard-earned, hard-won, and relatively recent rights have been taken away. We saw Suffs, a Broadway show a few weeks ago, which is about the suffragette movement. Co-produced by Hillary Clinton, by the way, who happened to be there that night and was given a rousing ovation by the audience. But I was struck all over again by how recent the vote and the sense of at least the possibility of equality was in our nation. It's a long, slow evolution. And when you think about Darwin's description of how long it took for the human being to emerge, it's perhaps not surprising that we're slow about this also. All of that being said, and the long view being a comfort, it is nonetheless and certainly the case that things are pretty awful today, and that I worry about my children and grandchildren.
You know, I want to go back as we move towards the end of our show. You have the seven homes. Usually I find it when a writer is moving, and I'm thinking about some of my college friends, like, okay, Ethelbert, we'll help you move, but you got all these books.
Okay,
yeah. You know, right? And so I was wondering, how do you downsize a library? Same way when we were talking about the cover of your book, there's items that you decide, okay, this is going to stay in the family. Okay, so I was wondering in terms of, okay, you're getting ready to move into maybe the third house or whatever. What books do you say I'm going to keep? You know, and I'm thinking of Langston Hughes, you know, when he's going after, like, he keeps Leaves of Grass. He throws everything else into the Hudson River, but he keeps that. Were there books that when you move, you say, okay, wherever I go, these books are going to stay with me? And then I'm wondering whether you say, okay, I'm going to keep these books because I've been stockpiling and these are the books I want to read. I'm going to get around to reading these books eventually. Even if I'm 85, 86, I'm going to get ready to read them.
Early on, I was a pretty avid accumulator of books. And
is that in quotes?
Well, also, I judged, as you've done, national contests, the National Book Award, the Pulitzer, et cetera, et cetera. And it was a time when 300 to 500 books would come to my door every year, and many of them I kept. Alan Chew's was like that. There was never a day in which there weren't books being delivered. Anyway, the first major move that Elena and I undertook was from Bennington, Vermont to Ann Arbor, Michigan. And I remember selling or giving away or taking to the local library actually 4,000 books, still having a hefty number of them to take west. And the same thing happened when we left Ann Arbor and settled in our downsized version of an apartment in New York and on the Cape, another 4,000 books, because by then I had accumulated them. So I'm quite used to this business of what you call triage. What troubles me still and what I wish I hadn't done was gotten rid of, or in some cases sold, the copies of books by friends, by people who had signed them over or had been an important part of my life. Those I miss. It turns out that I don't miss so much the thousands of books to which I had only a readerly connection, either a history of it or a prospect of it. Of the 4,000 that I first referred to, I found myself missing only one book acutely. I can't even remember its title or its author, but it was about the Children's Crusade. And I wanted at some point to read about it again and couldn't find it and wasn't able to get it from the local library. It turns out that they can't take what you carry in your head. And the number of books with which I'm surrounded is smaller now than it has been at any point in my adult life, but it doesn't deeply bother me because I do feel that if I require them, they're easy enough to have access to. The records of friendship, that's a different thing.
Right. You know, I'll end on this note as we get to the end, because before we get to here, I was joking with you. I was saying that Clarence, I was just reading Clarence Major's book of poems, 4 Days in Algeria.
Mm-hmm.
And he's 88 years old.
Right.
I'll be interviewing A.B. Spellman next month, and he's 89. So you were 82. So my question is, what are you going to be working on in the next couple of years?
Well, I have a book coming out this fall, this winter, which is the collected stories of Nicolas Del Banco. And there's some of that retrospect there, too. I mean, it's a reprinting of the two volumes of stories I published in the 80s and 90s, and then also the stories I've published more recently. And that's a fat book that's pushing 600 pages. And I'm kind of proud of it. I'm thinking it'll stop a few doors from closing. And, you know, like any other habit, it would be harder to break than it was to make. And so I get up every morning and I clack at the keys. I was at it for a couple of hours before you and I so happily broke to have this conversation. I'm working on another novel, and with any kind of luck, I'll finish it to my satisfaction.
Who would you feel are the good critics, the people who understand who you are, who get your work? Are there any people that have written about you that you say, okay, you know, this person knows what I'm doing?
They're mostly dead. and there are, you know, there was a time when I felt very much part of the conversation. Now, with the happy exception of this morning, I don't feel that so much any longer. I'm proud of my students, who, I guess the most famous of them is Jessamyn Ward, who was my student at the University of Michigan. There are any number of others, starting with Brett Ellis in the Bennington days, and Andrew Barrett in the middle. And
I'm glad you mentioned Jessamyn Ward, because she gave the Eudora Welty lecture at the National Press Club. I went up to her and I said, this was one of the finest things I had ever heard African-American writer read. And I felt it should have been every textbook. You know, it was personal. It was just, the range of it was fascinating, you know. And I just felt that, yes, but when you talk about your students, that's key. Where are your papers going to be housed?
In the early years when I was in Vermont, they were collected at Middlebury College. Mm-hmm. But basically, the bulk of what we call my archive is at the University of Michigan, because that's where the bulk of the work got accomplished. I moved there in 1985. I do want to say about Jessamyn, she was in a graduate class of mine at Michigan in Imitations. We read the work of several great modernists, by which I mean Hemingway and Virginia Woolf and James Joyce and William Faulkner. And she was this skinny, shy, silent creature in the back of the room. I mean, it was a small room. There were maybe a dozen of us. And frankly, I wasn't sure she was going to make it, because she was cold. She had migraines. She didn't seem at ease at all in the room. And I said to her, look, you know, take your time. And when you're ready, you can be part of the party. But until then, just sort of sit back and endure it. And to be perfectly honest, I didn't really think that there was all that much there. I thought there was a tin ear when she came to Imitating Hemingway or Virginia Woolf or what have you. And then we came to William Faulkner, and she just got it. She was just, in all my years of teaching, I don't think I ever saw so total a transformation. She opened her mouth and out came this really persuasive rhetoric. She'd found her voice, and it boomed. And it wasn't merely my feeling, it was everybody else in the room. They said, wow, where have you been? And from that moment on, she became herself.
And well, I want to tell you, Nicolas, that
I picked up Still Life at 80, and because I'm in my 70s now, and I said, oh, boom, this is what I can aspire to this. this will keep me going, you know, because what happens is, and I'm glad that, you know, you're talking about, you know, the book that's coming out, because we'll have to have you back for another program. So I want to thank you for taking time out this morning, Nicholas Del Banco, okay?
It was a great pleasure to be with you again, and I hope to be so in person sometime soon.
Okay, my guest today has been Nicholas Del Banco. We were talking about his memoir, Still Life at 80. The show's On the Margin. My name's E.S. Albert Miller. The station's WPFW 89.3 FM.
Code Pink, Women for Peace is coming to you live from Washington, D.C. and New York City, Thursday at 11 a.m. Code Pink Radio is an energizing new program focused on ending wars and militarism and building a peace economy. Listen weekly to robust conversation and inspiration from grassroots peacemakers from places like Korea, Yemen, Venezuela, Palestine, and Iran, as well as peacemakers in our nation's capital who are confronting war hawks in the White House and in Congress and modeling the actions we want our government to take. Again, that's Code Pink Radio, Thursdays at 11 a.m. on Washington, D.C.'s WPFW and New York City's WBAI, an engaging hour of cutting-edge conversation not to be missed.
We are women of the world. We're from the east, south, north, and west.
What do Angela Davis, Mehdi Hasan, Ibrahim X. Kendi, V, formerly Eve Ensler, Congresswoman Rashida Tlaib, Sonia Sanchez, Amy Goodman, Medea Benjamin, Mosab Abu Toha, Congresswoman Cori Bush, Noura Erekat, Congressman Jamal Bowman, Farafina Khan, Linda Sarsour, Isra Shakir, Congresswoman Ilhan Omar, Sweet Honey in the Rock, and WPFW have in common? Well, Busboys and Poets 2025 Peace Ball, Voice Voices of Justice and Liberation, an event featuring live music, speeches, performances, food, and drink. Details, including a complete list of speakers and performers, as well as how you can both support WPFW and join the fun on Saturday, January 18th, 8 p.m. at Arena Stage's Mead Center for American Theater, can be found at WPFWFM.org. That's WPFWFM.org. WPFW, building a better world. One broadcast at a time.
This is Rev Yearwood, and I am so excited to announce our new climate show, Think 100% Climate Friday. This show will keep you up to date on everything climate justice related in a rapidly changing world. We will discuss breaking news and updates on environmental issues, the climate crisis, COVID-19, and politics. This show will make tangible how the climate crisis is already impacting our lives and what you can do about it. So tune in every Friday at 9 o'clock a.m. right here on WPFW 89.3, your jazz and justice station.
We're back. WPFW is excited to announce the return of the Social Justice Calendar, your go-to weekly update on the latest events, actions, and initiatives promoting equity, justice, and change across our community. The calendar's mission is to connect you with the heartbeat of grassroots activism in the DMV. Each week, we'll spotlight rallies, workshops, forums, and community actions happening across the region. If you have an event to share, submissions can be emailed to socialjustice@wpfw.org. Please include the name, date, and address of said event in a format that is no longer than a sentence or two on Thursday at 5 p.m. Eastern Time, at least 2 weeks in advance of your event date. Space is limited, so submissions are considered in the order that they are received. The Social Justice Calendar is yet another way that WPFW connects, engages, and uplifts our community as we build a better world, one broadcast at a time.
Hey, Chris Garlock here.
And I'm Elise Bryant.
Tune in Thursdays at 1 p.m.
for the Labor Heritage Power Hour.
Every week, we explore labor arts and culture.
As anarchist Emma Goldman said so famously, If I can't dance, I don't want to be part of your revolution.
And that's how we feel about labor music, films,
theater, poetry,
labor history, labor art,
spoken word, basic